The second case for oral argument this morning is Lynette Hine, appellant versus Equity Appellee. For the appellant, Hine is Mr. James Leach, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Equity, is Ms. Susan Runick Simmons, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Leach, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Counsel, may it please the court. Lynette Hine was a construction worker. She hurt her back on the job. She gave proper notice to her employer. She could not return to work. She had to have back surgery. In recovering from the back surgery, she found, not surprisingly, that she wasn't going to be able to do construction work anymore. She filed a claim, pro se, for rehabilitation benefits. Up to this point, she had received about $50,000 in benefits, the vast majority of it, probably $40,000 in medical expenses. And this is where things start to go wrong. What goes wrong is that in response to her claim for rehabilitation benefits, she gets an answer denying for the first time that she gave proper notice of the original injury, and therefore denying that she was entitled to anything, and saying that the insurance company wants its $50,000 back. They don't use that number, but they say they want back everything they paid her, and in fact they had paid her $50,000. At that point, for the first time, she gets an attorney, me, and I respond to the answer and counterclaim by saying there's no point to it, there's no basis for it. It's asserted solely for the purpose of intimidating her from pursuing her legitimate lawful claim for rehabilitation benefits. Case goes forward, and lo and behold, right before the depositions of the employer's witnesses are going to be taken, the insurance company folds on the counterclaim, and they fold on the denial of notice. They admit to notice, and they agree that the claim for rehabilitation benefits should be handled simply on the merits. From that point forward, the claim for rehabilitation benefits is handled on the merits, and eventually it's settled shortly before it's scheduled to be tried.
Can I ask you just one fact, though?
Absolutely.
I see in your pleadings, you allege that Acuity admitted that the counterclaim lacked any basis. Is that?
They admitted it, not explicitly, but they admitted it by filing an amended answer,
okay,
withdrawing that claim totally.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. So we filed a bad faith claim based on our allegation that Acuity had filed a retroactive denial and a counterclaim with absolutely no basis in fact. We alleged they failed to make a reasonable investigation of the claim for rehabilitation benefits, and we alleged that their denial and counterclaim was stated for an improper purpose, namely the purpose of intimidation, and to make it even less likely that a pro se workers' comp claimant for rehabilitation benefits could get a lawyer. In response to our bad faith case, we get a motion to dismiss claiming that we have not stated a claim upon which relief can be granted. And that's the motion that the circuit court eventually grants. So the issue is very simply whether, taking as true all the facts that we allege in our amended complaint, did we state a claim upon which relief could be granted? We think there's a very simple answer to that question, and the simple answer is yes. The simple answer is provided by the Brooks case, which came up to this court in a very similar posture. Brooks pled a claim for bad faith, and the circuit court looked at it and said, oh, I don't think you have a claim for bad faith here. And this court said, well, here are the elements of bad faith. Here's what the plaintiff alleged. And yeah, the plaintiff sure did allege a claim for bad faith. Send the case back for discovery and presumably trial. That's a simple answer, but it really should be the end of the issue. But the circuit court obviously didn't think it was. The defense didn't agree that it was. And that's where we get into these other issues that are present in this appeal and that the circuit court thought were important in deciding the case.
The circuit court said that your claim was premature. I'm wondering what your thought about that is. The client has not yet been officially denied benefits. She's still in the process of making her claim. Why isn't it premature to sue for bad faith?
I think there are two answers to that, one factual and one legal. Factually, I'd just like to be as clear as I can as far as the facts here. Our bad faith case is about this denial based on lack of notice and the counterclaim. That's what we are saying is wrong, improper, no basis for it, no investigation either. When that goes out of the workers' comp case, that's when our bad faith claim based on that conduct is ripe. Because at that point, there's nothing left to exhaust. Those cases, that part of the case is out. What you're asking about and what seemed to be a factor for the circuit court is the fact that once that goes out, the rest of the rehabilitation claim continues. And for a rehabilitation claim, there are about five elements or six, depending on how you read Cosine. And we conceded that if you just look at the merits of the bad faith, I'm sorry, at the merits of the rehabilitation benefits claim, if you just look at that, there's room for argument. So we haven't claimed bad faith in that respect. The bad faith we're claiming and we're suing about, and we tried to make very clear by suing when we did, is the assertion of a counterclaim without a reasonable basis, without any factual basis, and for an improper purpose. And that when that's gone, there are no remedies left to exhaust under Zook.
What duty does Acuity have to your client to generate the an obligation to not put in a counterclaim such as the one they did?
They can do anything they want to do and be immune from bad faith liability so long as they have a reasonable basis. And the allegation is they had no reasonable basis at all. And the facts...
But traditionally, when you sue for bad faith, you're talking about no reasonable basis to deny a claim. And here, your client hasn't yet been denied a claim.
Well, there are several answers to that. Most specifically, I think, number one, she was retroactively denied. Because in the answer and counterclaim in the workers' comp case, Acuity says there was no basis for giving her these benefits. We made a mistake. We were in good faith. We were in error. So it's a retroactive denial. But even in addition to that point, we have Juulsen, which quotes the prior language that bad faith consists of denial of a workers' comp claim or denial of a claim without a reasonable basis. And then goes on to insert that bracketed language or other, I can't quote it to verbatim, but it's essentially other violation of other duties under the insurance contract.
All right, and that, okay, but your client does not have a contract with Acuity. And Juulsen, well, you're quoting from Juulsen, Juulsen is a suit by an insured against the insured's insurer, but this is a suit by a workers' compensation claimant against the employer's insurer.
Actually, the law is extremely clear that she is in exactly the same place as if she had signed the contract of insurance. And that comes originally from the case in South Dakota Champion recognizing bad faith in 1987. That was, in fact, a workers' comp case.
But that was also a workers' comp case dealing with a denial of a claim. Your client has not been denied a claim.
Right. And then in Juulsen, the court inserts that language that I just spoke with you about.
Okay. I mean, there's sort of a disconnect here, and I don't quite follow. In Juulsen, we're suing the insurance company because the company has denied an insured a claim. Whereas here, you're suing for a denial of a contract right, in a sense. You're using the second tier of the Juulsen liability. And you're saying that there's a breach of a contract. But there really isn't any contract here. And although we sometimes use the first party language, we've never said that that an insurance company has a contractual duty to an insured. Or am I wrong on that?
Yes.
I mean, not to an insured, but to a workers' compensation claimant.
Yes. I mean, every bad faith case that arises in the workers' comp context is based on that premise. And that premise comes from Colorado, where the court explicitly addresses that question. And in my opening brief, I include the case law on that point. Now, in the defense brief, there's one sentence that says, well, that shouldn't be for exactly the reason you're saying. But they don't cite any authority, not even a case, not even anything. So in my reply brief, I didn't address it further because there...
But I mean, even in the Colorado case, there's a denial of benefits, isn't there, that gives rise to it. Whereas here, we don't have a denial of benefits. We're really talking about something else. We're talking about a duty to, well, I think you were trying to quote it, and I guess I should look at it. Failure to comply with a duty under the insurance contract. And that's not what Colorado was dealing with either, is it? They're dealing with actually a denial of benefits.
I believe that's true. What we're dealing with here in this particular case...
This is really kind of a new situation here, isn't it? This is a little bit of a hybrid of what we had in Colorado.
I really don't think it is. And what we're dealing with is breach of the duty of good faith, simply, in a nutshell. And the essential point is that a breach of a duty of good faith can happen in more than one way. It can happen based on denial of benefits under the contract or on failure to, which is same if you're a workers' comp claimant, if you're an employer, whatever. Or it can happen if the insurance company does something else. Now, what's something else? You can look at Restatement Second of Contract, Section 205, where it talks about duty of good faith extending to the litigation of contract claims. You can look at what Professor Barron catalogs in his law article as all the different ways an insurance company can go wrong. He uses that as an example, and this, I believe, is straight from Restatement Second, Section 205, conjuring up a pretended dispute. And you know, you're a working person, you get hurt, and if in fact Acuity conjured up a pretended dispute, in other words, made up a claim with no basis that there was lack of notice, that sure sounds like bad faith. And that's exactly
isn't it
what
also
we alleged.
A denial of benefits if you ask for benefits and there's a counterclaim that says not only do we not owe you any benefits, you owe us for a mistaken payment of past benefits? Isn't that a denial of benefits?
Yes.
I understood you to say that you were not claiming there was a denial of benefits earlier.
Well, I didn't mean to say that if I did. It's not an initial denial, but it's a denial. It's a retroactive denial. We said that all the way through. We argued that in the circuit court.
But her original remedy that she asked for.
I'm sorry?
Her original remedy that she's asking for has yet to be decided. She was asking for rehabilitation benefits. That's still pending. So she hasn't exhausted her administrative remedy, has she?
Actually, that was decided by settlement a year ago.
Oh, that's not in the briefs.
No, and it wasn't. Okay. It wasn't before the circuit court because that's not what we sued on. I think the circuit court's decision, the more times I read it, is somewhat ambiguous, or at least unclear to me, on exactly what it's saying on that point. I mean, we tried to make our theory of this case as clear as we could by saying that the bad faith is concocting a counterclaim with absolutely no basis and for improper purposes. And the defense wants to put it over, well, it's about the merits, the rehabilitation benefits claim. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, I think when you look at these facts, I mean, there's a sense of right and wrong that stands behind these bad faith cases. And this is just wrong to take, you know, this working person, she's already had back surgery, she can't go back to work. All she wants is some rehabilitation benefits, which The circuit court thought they amounted to about $10,000. That's in the transcript of the argument. That's about what we told them. And she's pro se, and she's facing this impossible counterclaim. Now, if they had a basis, sure, that's fine. That's perfectly legitimate conduct. But if, in fact, the facts are, as we alleged, that the insurance company didn't do the investigation, didn't have anything to base this on, and did it for improper purpose, that's got to be wrong. And, I mean, the law of good faith and bad faith is very critical in terms of setting out how insureds and insurers interact. Not all workers' compensation claimants with small claims are going to get lawyers. Very few of them will. And just from this court's experience, most of the cases that come up here are the odd lot cases for obvious reasons, because there's enough money to fight about. It's rare that you see a rehabilitation benefits claim come all the way up here. And the circuit court recognizes that quite clearly. I don't know what weight you want to give to its comments about the process, but the circuit court says rehabilitation claimants can't get lawyers because there isn't enough money involved, and I couldn't do them when I was a lawyer, and et cetera. And I'm not saying you can or should change any of that. I'm just saying that this duty of good faith is an essential component of the system, and if an insurance company does what Acuity is alleged to have done in this case, then it's fair for it to be held accountable for what it did. There's a argument that appears several times in the from the defense and then in the circuit court to the effect of, well, all there was here is this answer and counterclaim, and you can't sue based upon what somebody said in a pleading. And what we pled is that our case not based on what was said in a pleading, it's based on the underlying conduct of the insurance company, of which the pleading is merely evidence. Because regardless of what's in their pleading, when the Acuity gets the rehabilitation benefits claim from Monette Hine, it has to do three things, we can say. One, it has to do a reasonable investigation. No doubt about that. That's crystal clear. Number two, any position it takes has to have a factual basis. And number three, they can't go about doing things for improper purposes, like trying to scare her out of pursuing her claim for rehabilitation benefits. That's everything we alleged, not merely that something was said in a pleading. The defense relies on 2011-5-2 and the Janklow and the Harris cases, and all those cases are cases about alleged defamation or hurt feelings based on something said in a pleading. The circuit court's vernacular on this, I think, is quite repeatable, where he says, I don't see how on this green earth we can call this a defamation claim, and nor can we call it a defamation claim dressed up to look like something else. The gravamen of this is what Acuity did in response to the rehabilitation benefits claim, totally separate and apart from what's said in the pleadings. There's also an argument made by the defense and accepted by Judge Delaney about needing to give a wide swath to legitimate litigation tactics. And again, with that general principle, we don't have a problem. But there are two parts of that that don't fit here. Number one is to say, well, this is just litigation tactics. No, it's a claim. Acuity has some duties before they even get to the courthouse. They have some things they have to do before they file their response. Number two is the question of what's legitimate. Well, if what we allege in our amended complaint is true, this is not legitimate. It's about the most illegitimate thing someone could think of. There are cases, you know, cases from every jurisdiction here, there, and everywhere discussed in the briefs. But really, you don't have to go any further than South Dakota law to address this question of legitimate litigation tactics. We have two cases in South Dakota. We have a 1994 case, which is escaping me, the name is escaping me right now, where the Isaac versus State Farm, where we've got a lawsuit going on. One party comes in and says, well, we'll settle your case. We'll pay you if you give up your bad faith claim. And that's bad faith. That's in the course of litigation. We've got Harder versus Plains in 1998. Insurance company comes in and says, well, we want to subrogate and we want to intervene. And this court says, we agree that the mere retention of those rights cannot be bad faith, but neither of these procedures are intended to impair the rights of the insurer. In that factual situation, the insurance company had accepted the claim prior to getting the litigation.
Thank you, Mr. Leach. Your time has expired.
Exactly the situation here.
Ms. Simmons, you have 20 minutes.
I beg the court's indulgence. I have a medical condition that makes my mouth go totally dry in rather stressful situations. Not that I'm expecting this to be stressful, but I have to bring a lot of water to me.
I'm sure it won't be, but you can have the water anyway.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sue Simons, and I am here on behalf of Acuity Insurance Company. And we are here to ask this court to affirm the decision of Judge Delaney in dismissal of this pending bad faith claim for purposes that it does fail to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. We are aware, obviously, of the severe nature of a motion to dismiss. But what we're talking about here is a privilege, is an immunity. And this court has held previously that when issues are of privilege and immunity, that motions to dismiss are, in fact, a proper method to address that. In listening to Mr. Leach and in reviewing his briefs again before coming to oral argument, one of the first things he said when he stood up here, and what is repeated at least in 2 to 3 paragraphs of the amended complaint and throughout his brief, is that Ms. Hine had a legitimate claim for rehabilitation benefits. That issue cannot be part of this litigation. This court made it unequivocally clear in Zook versus Presentation Systems that you must exhaust administrative remedies before you can bring a claim of bad faith. Now, granted, you have to take the facts as alleged in a pleading as true, but you can't take facts that are legally improper and then assume that they're true for purposes of litigation. The issue of retraining benefits cannot be a part of the bad faith lawsuit that was initiated by Ms. Hine. So therefore, every time there's an allegation that she had a quote-unquote legitimate claim, that is not before this court.
Well, now, what we just found out here, because I don't think it was in the briefs, that the case has been settled. So does that change the situation where now if she's settled and perhaps obtained benefits, that now she does have a legitimate claim?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that a settlement of a claim would ever lead to an adjudication that the claim was legitimate. I think Zook said we need a ruling by the agency that has the authority to issue that determination, and if they say it's legitimate, then we can talk about bad faith if, in fact, there was a denial of those benefits. Mr. Leach has already conceded that it was not bad faith to challenge the claim for retraining benefits. It was fairly debatable. So regardless of what had ultimately come of that, there has been a concession that issue was debatable.
Then doesn't that go against your argument and that it can be separated, the two issues, the bad faith and the claim that is being or was currently at that time being pursued in the administrative court?
No, Your Honor, because what he's trying to do here is say it's separated, but it's the denial of the retraining that, in part, forms the basis of their bad faith claim. They allege, that Acuity sat back and said, how can we defeat this retraining claim? We can defeat that by concocting a notice defense and ask for money back that might have been paid in good faith. That goes to the rehab claim. That rehab claim is not before the court. So they're trying to backdoor the ability to come in on a bad faith claim, as Justice Delaney noted, or Judge Delaney, excuse me, noted, prematurely.
And I'm not getting to the prematurely point. If it was premature to bring this, why would Judge Delaney enter a dismissal with prejudice?
The dismissal with prejudice was based upon Judge Delaney's determination that the allegations made in the answer, counterclaim, and amended answer are absolutely protected by the judicial privilege in the state of South Dakota, and under no circumstances can they form the basis of a lawsuit. That is with prejudice. They can't come back in and say, again, on the basis of the allegations made in that answer and counterclaim, we have a cause of action for bad faith.
But as I understand it, they have other, more than just that. They have a claim that she was injured, and there's certainly law to the effect that you can use pleadings that are meritless as evidence of bad faith.
But without these pleadings, Your Honor, there's no denial of benefits. There's nothing. You take away these pleadings. If, in fact, as this court has recognized, the privilege in a judicial pleading is absolute, you take those away from the facts of this case, they have no facts.
So everything that's actionable is contained within the pleading?
Everything that is actionable in their allegation, and their only allegation is bad faith, is contained in the pleadings. They want to say, well, we sat around and did all of these things, acuity, sat around and did these things. But in essence, they would say that you could never investigate a claim. You take their to the logical conclusion. Claim comes across my desk. I never investigate it. I pay it. Aha. Bad faith. You have a duty to investigate that claim. First of all, there has to be somehow a communication of a denial. Where is the communication of the denial in this case?
When you sue for a counterclaim, don't you think that's the equivalent of a denial
Absolutely.
Of benefits?
First of all, Your Honor, it's an allegation. This is a pleading. We state and allege. It is not a verified pleading. It's something that is subject to proof.
But if it has no basis, what is her recourse?
Well, Your Honor, it's not bad faith.
Is it a Rule 11 if you've not done any...
She has lots of... She can, if she wants, she can either acuity or she can submit my name to the state bar for violating my ethical obligation in signing a pleading that had no factual basis or that I did not believe had a factual basis. There's ethical obligations that are also consistent here. She could file other types of claims, but that's not what she claimed.
But you're just an agent for the insurance company. She claims that they're the principal... And they failed to properly investigate it, and then they
what
and
did
then
we
they
fail
act,
to?
And then they acted in a, for an improper purpose, and that's the basis of their claim. So they're going after the principal; they're not going after the principal's agent.
The statements were made by the principal's agents. The statement were made in a signed pleading by the attorney.
Yeah, and the attorney is the agent for the principal,
absolutely,
right?
But the attorney has a higher obligation than just being an agent for attorney. The attorney's in the state.
Right now, we're just concentrating on the lower obligation of what the insurance company has to do.
Correct.
You say that they can fail to investigate something and pay it, and then they're still liable, but let's do the reverse of that. If they fail to investigate something and if equivalently deny it, Are they immune from liability simply because they put it in a pleading and it was a privileged deal?
If the privilege is absolute, yes, it is, because this court has made it clear
but
that
the
absolute nature of the privilege. If we say absolute, it means absolute, that the purpose behind it, the state of mind, which is exactly what they're alleging here, the state of mind of acuity in making the communication is not material or relevant if, in fact, the pleading is privileged.
My argument is the privilege isn't so broad. The privilege goes just to the words of the denial and the pleadings. It's not so broad to give immunity to a bad faith, bad investigation, and conduct for an improper purpose. There's a difference.
Actually, improper purpose is purpose, regardless of whether it's proper or improper. And the court has said absolute privilege applies regardless of what the purpose is. There's no good faith exception. In other words, you don't have to have a good faith statement. If it's in a pleading, if it's in a judicial pleading, it is subject to the absolute privilege. And that's not there's a purpose behind that as well. And that is to allow advocacy. Now, you have to look at this pleading. This was not There was an alternative paragraph in this pleading. This was a typical pleading that says we went paragraph by paragraph by her allegations, and then the final statement was, in the alternative, if in fact she proves all these things, then we've paid her all the benefits she's entitled to, which gets back to the legitimate retraining claim. So it wasn't as if this answer didn't have an alternative pled that said, in the alternative, we paid her everything that she's been paid.
Taking your argument to its logical conclusion, are you saying the insurance company can protect bad and improper actions simply by putting in a counterclaim that becomes privileged once it's part of the lawsuit?
I'm saying if that's the only way that was communicated, if that's the only statement, the only evidence of a denial has to come out of a statement made in a signed pleading in an administrative agency in the state of South Dakota, that yes, because it's absolutely privileged. There's no communication of a denial. And I beg to differ that you do not need a denial in the state of South Dakota to have it. And I would like to point out, if I could just take it diverse here maybe for a second, on Juulsen in this edition of this bracketed language that somehow gives a new requirement to bad faith. The only case after Juulsen that this court has decided that is specific to bad faith in workers' compensation, of course a case near and dear to my heart, is Gilchrist versus Trail King Industries. And in that case, when the court once again reiterated what is the two-pronged standard for bad faith litigation in workers' compensation cases in the state of South Dakota, the bracketed language is not there. So Mr. Leach's assertion that since Juulsen, every bad faith case has included the bracketed language is not correct. And I go back to what Justice Konenkamp stated when he was talking to Mr. Leach, and that is, this is an anomaly. Workers' compensation is an anomaly anyway. But it certainly is, and when we're talking about the relationships between the insured and the insurer. That bracketed language in Juulsen talked about a specific duty within that contract of insurance because it was a first-party insurance claim. And that had to do with the duty in regard to subrogation. It was a contractual duty. That was the issue in that case. It was also the issue in the two cases that came. But that's not what we're talking about here. Mr. Leach is doing a circle here. There's an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in every contract. That's what forms the basis of a bad faith allegation. He wants to take that implied duty and put it back in there as a way to prove bad faith because of this language in Juulsen. And that doesn't make any sense because there is no implied contractual duty to perform something that's at issue in a bad faith workers' compensation case, and that's why it's absent, noticeably, when this court had to address that again in Gilchrist. But I would like to talk about...
Before you go there,
sure.
Let me take you back. You know, this thing about whether this is premature, this is a 12B5 case.
Yes.
We've got to treat the pleaded facts as true.
Facts, correct.
We have paragraphs 11, 14, and 17, which all allege things other than acts in the pleadings. Failure to conduct a reasonable investigation, failure to evaluate the claim fairly, and not having a good faith belief to deny benefits retroactively. This complaint was dismissed with prejudice. It seems to me that in essence, these allegations are now foreclosed, even though they have nothing to do with pleadings, that they're foreclosed forever by res judicata and other principles, and that doesn't seem appropriate.
I guess I disagree with that, Judge Sinner.
Which part?
With the part that those allegations are foreclosed, because Judge Delaney referenced, when you get all done with this case, if you want to come in and use these pleadings as evidence, you still have a right to do that, but you cannot base the claim for bad faith solely on the statements in the pleading. That's what the motion to dismiss was. The motion to dismiss had nothing to do with that. But if the answer, and this is what Delaney had and Mr. Leach has never been able to give a response to, if you take the answer and counterclaim out of this lawsuit, what facts, what basis do you have to claim that Acuity acted in bad faith.
What about 11, 14, and 17?
They don't know that because there would have been no denial. There would have been no communication, which, by the way, defamation is based upon a communication. That's where we come to the absolute privilege. There would have been no communication. They would have had to make that up out of thin air.
Well, they say that they did not conduct a reasonable investigation.
And if we had not filed the answering counterclaim, how could they make that allegation?
Well, they can make it because I presume they're going to look at the internal practices of the company, look at the files, and see what happened. See what kind of investigation they actually did. That's the way it's typically proved.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. But as Mr. Leach noted in his reply brief, when she filed this complaint, she didn't have to know every fact before bringing the lawsuit. But he's claiming Acuity had to know every fact before bringing their answer to the petition for hearing. And that's why we got to get the pleadings out of this.
Well, let's get them out.
Okay.
I know what's going to happen. If this is dismissed with prejudice and they refile now that there's been a settlement and they just allege failure to conduct a reasonable investigation, Acuity is going to say res judicata. This claim has been dismissed.
I believe, Your Honor, that absent a communication, there is no way, shape, or form that there could be any knowledge or factual basis to assert that Acuity did not conduct a reasonable investigation.
But what if counsel can do some discovery and find that the company sent a memo out saying to the effect, you know, go ahead and put in this claim. We'll knock her off her feet with this.
Okay. And Your Honor,
isn't he entitled to do some discovery?
Absolutely not. Not if the absolute privilege applies. This court has said more than once that discovery concerning the truth or the purpose or state of mind is meaningless as the privilege is absolute. It says, because of this absolute privilege, the purpose behind the state of mind, and that's all said in Harris as well as in Wong. And that's why. That's why lawyers have to be allowed to file pleadings, sign them, and file them with the understanding that the statements made therein are absolutely privileged. If, in fact, there's other conduct, which there is in every other case cited by Mr. Leach, there was a denial of benefits before a pleading. There was a denial by the insurance company. There was no denial in this case absent the pleading. And that's why the case was dismissed for failure to state a claim. The California physician's case out of California is directly on point. Jess Gilbertson, you've noticed previously in a concurrence, when we can look to California law, when our field code or when our source specifically relates to the field code, and the absolute privilege refers right to California Code 47. Physician service case that we cited in our brief is the only case cited by either party that is directly on point in this case, and that is you may not claim bad faith based on allegations, statements made in a pleading. The filing of a defensive pleading is a privileged communication which cannot be the basis for a retaliatory action in tort. In fact, the court was so inflamed it said that it was obligated to terminate that spurious cause of action. It said to permit a plaintiff to impose tort liability on a defendant for positions asserting in pleadings not only imposes an unfair burden on the conduct of the defense, but conflicts with the well-established rule which permits the asserting of two or more inconsistent pleas. The holding was, defensive pleadings, including the assertion of affirmative defenses, is communication protected by the absolute litigation privilege. Such pleading, even though allegedly false, interposed in bad faith, or even asserted for inappropriate purposes, cannot be used for the allegation of ongoing bad faith. No complaint can be grounded on such pleading. This court has previously said in Keller, we looked to 47. We know California Court 47 is identical. It adopted the four-prong test from California. And yet the only case that either side has cited that's directly on point is from California. Therefore, it should be obviously not definitive, but fairly persuasive. Plus, we have cited to numerous other jurisdictions. I don't care if you call it medical malpractice. I don't care if you call it intentional infliction of emotional distress. I don't care what you call the tort. If the basis for that tort comes out of statements that are made, signed by an attorney in the state of South Dakota under ethical obligations to make sure that it is correct, those allegations may not form the basis of a tort. That's what Judge Delaney came down to. That's all. You take out the pleadings in this case. That's what the motion to dismiss was. As the basis of liability, they have no other facts.
Well, they're only in the pleading stage.
Yeah. But, Your Honor, if it's absolutely privileged, the state of mind...
What do you say, though, to those cases that say that these types of pleadings can be evidence of bad faith?
I believe, Your Honor, if they had other facts, if they had a prior denial...
What facts does an attorney have to come up with in a Rule 12 motion? This is a pleadings case.
They have to come up with facts that are not... They have to come up with facts, not conclusions. Facts. They admit... I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm out of time.
So. Thank you. Mr. Leach, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'll try to speak to the points that I think are the heart of this, and if the court would help me with what it sees as the heart, I'll try to speak to those points. Justice Zinter and Justice Konenkamp, I liked your questions, especially yours at the end, Justice Konenkamp, because I think it puts the focus exactly where it should be, that this is a 12b-5 case, and it's really a lot simpler than it may seem from all the briefs. There are some interesting issues here, perhaps even fascinating in bad faith law, none of which we ever have to get to. The defense position over and over again is that somehow what they've done here is absolutely privileged. And that's not the law. Of course, it comes from 2011-5-2, their concept. And 2011-5-2 just doesn't go that far. We know it goes to the Janklow facts. We know it goes to Harris versus Riggenbach. But there's nothing that says that just because an insurance company takes and has its agent sign something on its behalf, that then the insurance company, the principal, is absolved from all liability, sort of like an attorney is sort of the magic middle-aged touchstone we're going to dip our pleading in, and then the pleading becomes golden and can never be evidence of anything. And then in addition, everything the insurance company did prior to that, prior to having the attorney sign it, now all of a sudden becomes absolutely immune and absolutely privileged.
Now, she stated flatly, if I understand it correctly, that 100% of the tortious acts are committed within the scope of that pleading and therefore privileged, and there's nothing outside that pleading. Can you point to facts that are outside the pleading, allegations or whatever?
I point to facts and law. I mean, we don't have the facts as to what happened. Let me back up. We know she made the claim. That's a fact, because we got the pleading in the appendix to our brief. And we know that what comes back is the pleading signed by the counsel saying, no notice, everything was paid improperly, you have to pay us back everything. We don't yet know what happened in the middle. And that's what we want to find out. But we do know that either there was something in the middle or there was nothing in the middle.
But what well-pleaded facts are you alleging are in the middle?
Okay.
In this complaint, what is a well-pleaded fact that would show something other than filing the counterclaim occurred?
Those paragraphs that you cited, 11, 12, 14.
Are those facts or conclusions?
Those are assertions.
Okay, in that regard, then, let me ask you this. You know, I counted them up, and there's probably four or five that could be arguably well-pleaded facts, not within the counterclaim. There's several that go the other way. But at the conclusion of your pleading, paragraph 31, you summarize what this case is all about. And you say, since this lawsuit challenges acuities, bad faith counterclaim, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me that summary is saying exactly what Ms. Simons is saying, and that is that this is a case about filing a counterclaim.
Well, no, I don't think you can take just one paragraph and say that trumps all the other preceding paragraphs. I think you have to take the pleading together, but the point I wanted to make is that...
But it says, since this lawsuit challenges acuity's bad faith counterclaim, that's not a summary of what this case is all about?
Well, the preceding paragraphs allege lack of reasonable investigation, lack of a factual basis, and improper purpose. So that's all there. But the other point I want to make is that once the claim is made, Acuity has these duties that are non-delegable. They're inherent in the nature of insurance to have a reasonable basis for what it did, to make a reasonable investigation, and not to act for an improper purpose. And when I say they either did or they didn't do these things, I mean either they looked at this thing and did something about it, did an investigation or not, had a factual basis or not, had an improper purpose or not, or on the other hand, if they just stuck their head in the sand, if they really did nothing, then that's bad faith by itself for failure to investigate and failure to have a reasonable basis for simply passing the claim along to counsel instead of granting the claim or trying to settle it or something along those lines.
So if I understand correctly then, the settlement that we now just learned about in this case really is irrelevant because you're not suing for a bad faith denial of the rehabilitation benefits. Is that right?
We are not suing based on the merits of the claim. The denial, the bad faith denial is where they come in and say, we never should have paid you any benefits. And they're retroactively denying. Yes, there's that denial. But then that is out of the case once they back off and say, well, we were wrong, you know, there's no basis for this, we withdraw it.
So there is, so I mean, I'm not sure I understand retroactive denial, but I mean, you're not claiming now that your client was denied rehabilitation benefits.
She was in that.
Temporarily. She was, there was a suspension, but ultimately she hasn't been denied benefits, if I understand correctly.
Yes, and that's the case in many, many of these cases. Champion, which originally came to you in 1987, the statement of facts from Judge Bogue was about one paragraph, and it said the workers' comp claimant got benefits for a year and a half. Then they were suspended for a period of time, about another year and a half. But now the insurance company has stipulated that all benefits have been paid. I mean, and on total permanent disability, of benefits have been paid. So it's just like Champion or any number of other cases that could come up here. Which I suppose brings me to another point Ms. Brunick made, saying that, well, we have to litigate to conclusion the workers' comp claim before we could have a bad faith case based on it. And that's contrary to the policy of the law to encourage settlements. And it would mean that every one of these workers' comp cases where there's a bad faith issue has to be tried through to conclusion. And that's not the law. It's never been the law. I mean, in addition, the insurance company has a duty to engage in reasonable settlement negotiations and to settle a claim where liability has become reasonably clear. That's got nothing to do with whether they arguably could deny the claim in its entirety. Ms. Brunick argues that every case we cite, it was something other than conduct in a pleading. There was something other than a denial. That's just not true. I addressed that in my reply brief. You can find all the cases in there. There's in particular the case CRISA, K-R-I-S-A, from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, applying Pennsylvania law, in which the bad faith claim was brought based exactly on an insurance company putting in a denial and a counterclaim and then withdrawing it. And the bad faith case goes forward based on the allegation there was no basis for the counterclaim. Ms. Brunick also says that the BRCA language that I'm talking about that first appears in Juulsen has not appeared in other cases. There are two cases cited in my brief, Steen and Sawyer, in which that BRCA language appears. So it does appear repeatedly.
Let me take you back to facts one more time.
Please.
You know, what it sounds like, I hate to use the word fishing expedition because it has a negative connotation with it, but it sounds to me like you want to go do some discovery. You really don't know or don't have any, other than suspicion and other than filing this counterclaim, you really don't have any fact that suggests there was a failure to investigate or a failure to evaluate. It sounds like you just want to go do the discovery and figure that out. Is that right?
Well, I'd like to tell you two things. Number one, yes, we'd like to do discovery. In an insurance bad faith case, of course, the evidence is in the hands of the insurance company, and we don't have any way to get it other than burglary or discovery. But the other thing I'd like to tell you is that just on the face of these facts, I mean, they accept the claim. They pay it. For 9 months, it's being paid. 7 months, it's being paid. And then the only thing that happens is this counterclaim, the claim for rehabilitation benefits, and all of a sudden, whoops, everything's upside down. Now,
your time has expired.
That seems to me a pretty plain case for our theory. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes. Okay.